The following letter of Jonathan Edwards was written to James Robe of Scotland during the revival at Kilsyth, Scotland, after 1740. Northampton, May 12, 1743. Reverend and dear sir, last week I was surprised with the unexpected favor of your letter, with one from Mr. John McLaurin, who may well make me blush at the consideration of my vileness to receive such undeserved testimonies of respect from servants of the Lord at so great a distance, and that have been so highly favored and honored of God as you have been. Pleasant and joyful are the accounts which we have lately had from Scotland concerning the kingdom of our God there, for which we in the world are especially indebted to you, who have honored your dear Lord and refreshed and served his church by the accounts you have published in your narrative and journals of the work of God in Kilsyth and other parts in the West Scotland. Future generations will own themselves indebted to you for those accounts. I congratulate you, dear sir, on the advantages God has put you under to favor the Church of God with a narrative of his glorious works, by having made you the instrument of so much of them, and giving you such glorious success in your own congregation. The accounts which we have received from you are, on some accounts, more pleasant and agreeable than what we have had to send to you. The work of God with you has been less mixed with error and extravagance. You have taken a more wise and prudent care to prevent things of that nature, or to suppress them as soon as they have appeared. And ministers that have been the principal promoters of the work have seemed to be more happily united in their sentiments, and so under greater advantage to assist one another, and to act as co-workers and fellow helpers. You have heard great things from New England of late, which I doubt not have refreshed and rejoiced your hearts. And indeed great and wonderful have the things been in which God has passed before us. But now we have not such joyful news to send to you. The clouds have lately thickened, and our hemisphere is now much darkened with them. There is a great decay of the work of God amongst us, especially as to the awakening and converting influence of the Spirit of God, and the prejudices there are in a great part of the country are riveted and inveterate. The people are divided into two parties, those that favor the work and those that are against it, and the distinction has long been growing more and more visible, and a distance greater, until there is at length raised a wall between them up to heaven, so that one party is very much out of the reach of all influence of the other. There is very much owing to imprudent management and the friends of the work, and a corrupt mixture which Satan has found means to introduce, and our manifold sinful errors by which we have grieved and quenched the Spirit of God. It can scarcely be conceived of what consequence it is to the continuance and propagation of a revival of religion, that the utmost care be used to prevent error and disorder among those that appear to be the subjects of such a work, and also that all imaginable care be taken by ministers in conducting souls under the work, and particularly that there be the greatest caution used in comforting and establishing persons as being safe and past danger of hell. Many among us have been ready to think that all high raptures are divine, but experience plainly shows that it is not the degree of rapture and ecstasy, although it should be to the third heavens, but the nature and kind that must determine us in their favor. It would have been better for us if all ministers here had taken care diligently to distinguish such joys and raised affections as were attended with deep humiliation, brokenness of heart, poverty of spirit, mourning for sin, solemnity of spirit, a trembling reverence towards God, tenderness of spirit, self-jealousy and fear, and great engagedness of heart after holiness of life, and a readiness to esteem others better than themselves, and that sort of humility that is not a noisy, showy humility, but rather this which disposes to walk softly and speak trembling. And if we had encouraged no discoveries or joys, but such as is manifestly wrought this way, it would have been well for us. And I am persuaded we shall generally be sensible before long that we run too fast, when we endeavor by our positive determinations to banish all fears of damnation from the minds of men, though they may be true saints, if they are not such as are eminently humble and mortified, and what the Apostle calls rooted and grounded in love, Ephesians 3:17. It seems to be running before the Spirit of God. God by His Spirit does not give assurance or any other way than by advancing these things in the soul. He does not wholly cast out fear, the legal principle, but by advancing and filling the soul full of love, the evangelical principle. When love is low in the true saints, they need the fear of hell to deter them from sin and engage them to exactness in their walk and stir them up to seek heaven. But when love is high and the soul is full of it, we don't need to fear. And therefore, a wise God has so ordered it that love and fear should rise and fall like the scales of a balance. When one rises, the other falls, as there is need, or as light and darkness take place of each other in a room. As light decays, darkness comes in, and as light increases and fills a room, darkness is cast out. So love, or the spirit of adoption, casts out fear, the spirit of bondage. And experiences convinces me that even in the brightest and most promising appearances of new converts, it would have been better for us to have encouraged them only, as it were, conditionally, after the example of the apostle in Hebrews 3, verse 5, "Whose house are we if we hold fast to confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm unto the end?" And Hebrews 3, verse 14, "For we are made partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast unto the end." And after the example of Christ in Revelation 2, verse 10, "Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life." It is probable that one reason why God has allowed us to err is to teach us wisdom by experience of the ill consequences of our errors. What you relate of the opposition of the seceding ministers is very surprising, especially of the two Erskines, whose writing, especially Mr. Ralph Erskine's Gospel Sonnets, have been in great repute among God's people here. But this is a day of wonders, of various kinds. I have reason to admire divine condescension in making any use of anything I have written for the defense of the work of God in Scotland. As to what you propose concerning my writing and narrative and so on, I am not conveniently situated for it. Living in an extreme part of the land and 100 miles from the press, as well as on many other accounts unfit for it. But Thomas Prince of Boston, who is every way fit, and under good advantages for it, has already undertaken it, and I suppose will prosecute the undertaking, so far as it shall be thought for God's glory. I hope, dear sir, you'll remember me in your prayers. Never was I so sensible in any measure how vain a creature man is, what a leaf driven of the wind, what dry stubble, what poor dust, a bubble, a shadow, a nothing, and a more vain than nothing. And what a vain and vile, helpless creature I am, and how much I need God's help in everything as of late. Dear sir, don't forget New England, and don't forget your affectionate and obliged brother and servant and an unworthy fellow laborer, Jonathan Edwards. The following letter of Jonathan Edwards is to William McCulloch of Scotland, dated March 5th. 1743. Reverend and dear sir, I return your thanks for your most obliging, entertaining, and instructive letter, dated August 13th, 1743, which I received about the latter end of October. My answering, which has been unhappily delayed by reason of my distance from Boston, and not being able to find any opportunity to send there until the ship was gone that brought your letter, which I much regretted. My delay in to answer has been far from arising from any indifference with respect to this correspondence, by which I am sensible. I am highly honored and privileged. It is probable that you have been informed by other correspondents before now what the present state of things in New England is. It is indeed, on many accounts, very melancholy. There is a vast alteration within this 2 years, for about so long, I think it is, since the Spirit of God began to withdraw, and its great work has been on the decline. Great numbers in the land, about 2 years ago, were raised to an exceeding great height, in joy and elevations of mind, and through want of watchfulness and sensibleness of the danger and temptation that there is in such circumstances, many were greatly exposed. the devil taken the advantage. Multitudes were soon and to themselves insensibly led far away from God and their duty. God was provoked that he was not sanctified in his height of advancement, as he ought to have been. He saw our spiritual pride and self-confidence, and the polluted flames that arose of intemperate, unhallowed zeal. And he soon, in a great measure, withdrew from us, and the consequence has been that the enemy has come in like a flood in various respects, until the deluge has overwhelmed the whole land. There had from the beginning been a great mixture, especially in some places, of false experiences and false religion with the true. But from about this time, the mixture became much more greater. Many were led away with sad delusions, and this opened the door for the enemy to come in like a flood in another respect. It gave great advantage to the enemies and opposers of this work, furnished them with weapons and gave them new courage, and has laid the friends of the work under such disadvantages that nothing that they could do would avail anything to withstand their violence. And now it has come to that the work has put to a stop everywhere, and it is a day of the enemy's triumph, but I believe also a day of God's people's humiliation, which will be better to them in the end in their elevations and raptures. The time has been amongst us when the sower went forth to sow, and we have seen the spring in which the seed sprang up in different sorts of ground, appearing then fair and flourishing. But the spring is past, and we now see the summer in which the sun is up with a burning heat that tries the sorts of ground. And now appears the difference. The seed in stony ground, where there is only a thin layer of earth on a rock, withers away, the moisture being dried out, and the hidden seeds and roots of thorns in unsubdued ground now springs up and chokes the seed of the word. Many high professors are fallen, some into gross immoralities, some into the opinions of sectaries, some into a rooted spiritual pride, enthusiasm, and an incorrigible wildness of behavior, some into a cold, carnal frame of mind, showing a great indifference to things of religion. But there are many, and I hope those, the greater part of those that were professed converts, appear hitherto like the good ground, and notwithstanding the thick and dark clouds that so soon follow that blessed sunshine that we have had, yet I cannot but steadfastly maintain in hope and persuasion that God will revive his work, and that what has been so great and very extraordinary is a forerunner of a yet more glorious and extensive work. It has been slanderously reported and printed concerning me that I have often said that the millennium was already begun, and that it began at Northampton. A doctor of divinity in New England has ventured to publish this report to the world from a single person who is concealed and kept behind a curtain. But the report is very diverse from what I have ever said. Indeed, I have often said, as I say now, that I looked upon the late wonderful revivals of religion as forerunners of those glorious times so often prophesied of in the Scripture, and that this was the first dawning of that light and beginning of that work, which in the progress and issue of it would at last bring on the Church's latter-day glory. But there are many that know that I have from time to time added that there would probably be many sore conflicts and terrible convulsions, and many changes, revivings, and intermissions, and returns of dark clouds and threatening appearances before this work shall have subdued the world, and Christ's kingdom shall be everywhere established and settled in peace, which will be the beginning of the millennium, or day of the Church's peace, rejoicing and triumph on earth, so often spoke of. I was much entertained and delighted, dear sir, with your thoughts on that text in Isaiah 59, verse 19, which you signify in your letter, and so have many others been to whom I have communicated them. And as to what you say of some dreadful stroke or trial yet abiding before the happy days of the promised peace and prosperity of the Church, I so far agree with you that I believe that before the Church of God shall have obtained the conquest an invisible kingdom of Satan on earth shall receive its overthrow, and Christ's kingdom of grace be everywhere established on its ruins. There shall be a great and mighty struggle between the kingdom of Christ and the kingdom of Satan, attended with the greatest and most extensive convulsions and commotions that have ever were upon the face of the earth, wherein doubtless many particular Christians will suffer, and perhaps some parts of the church. But that the enemies of the church of God should ever gain such advantages against her any more, as they have done in times past, that the victory should ever any more be on their side, or that it shall ever be given to the beast again to make war with the saints and to prevail against them and overcome them, to such a degree as been heretofore, is otherwise than I hope, though in this I would be far from setting my own judgment up in opposition to others who are more skilled in the prophecy of the Scripture than I am. Think that what has mainly induced many divines to be of that opinion is what is said in Revelation 11 concerning the slain of the witnesses, verses 7 and 8. And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them and kill them, and their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city which spiritually is called Sodom in Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. The event here spoken of seems evidently to be that wherein the enemies of the church gain the greatest advantage against her that ever they have, and have the greatest conquest of her that ever they obtain, and bring the church nearest to a total extinction. For a long time the church is very small, represented by two witnesses, and they had been long in a very low state, prophesying in sackcloth, but now they are dead, and their enemies triumph over them as having gotten a complete victory, and look upon it that they are now past all possibility of recovery, there being less prospect of the church's restoration than ever there was before. But are we to expect this, dear sir, that Satan will ever find means to bring things to that pass, that after all the increase of light that has been in the world since the Reformation, there shall be a return of a more dark time than in the depth of the darkness of popery before the Reformation, when the Church of God shall be nearer to a total extinction and have less of visibility, all true religion and light more blotted out of the memories of mankind, Satan's kingdom of darkness more firmly established, all monuments of true religion more abolished, and that the state of the world should be such that it should appear further from any hope of a revival of true religion than ever it is done? Is this conceivable or possible as the state of things now is all over the world, even among papists themselves, without a miracle, a greater than any power short of divine can effect, without a long tract of time gradually to bring it to pass, to introduce the grossest ignorance and extinguish all memory and monuments of truth, which was the case in that great extinction of true religion that was before the Reformation? And besides, if we suppose this war of the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit, with the witnesses in which he overcomes them and kills them, to be that last war which the churches shall have with the beast, that great and mighty conflict that shall be just before the final overthrow of Antichrist, that we read of in the 16th chapter and the 13th and following verses, and in the 19th chapter, how shall we make them consist together? And so on. Jonathan Edwards. For more recordings, go to sermonaudio.com and do a search at The Narrated Puritan. On the history of revivals in America, the First and Second Great Awakening, possibly the revival of 1859. Well, for the Men of God podcast, for the first time, I want to do a little bit of research into the First Great Awakening in the Baptist in the 18th century. I'm taking this from Your Baptist Heritage by Isaac Backus, 1620 to 1804. Chapter 9, George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards, 1735 to 1745. The low state of religion in our land, but a glorious revival was now granted, and it spread far, and so on. The first fathers of New England held that each believer stands in the same relation to his children as Abraham did to his in the covenant of circumcision, and therefore that each believer had a right to bring his children to baptism, which no others had. But 40 years after, a door was opened for those who had been baptized in infancy and were not scandalous to bring their infants to baptism, though none were to come to the ordinance of the supper without a profession of saving grace. Yet in 40 years more, an open plea was published before described for all baptized persons who were not openly scandalous to come to the Lord's Supper, as well as to bring their children to baptism. And in a third 40 years, these things had turned the world into the church, and the church into the world, in such a manner as to leave very little difference between them. But, as it is said of false teachers, they are of the world, therefore speak they of the world, and the world hears them. So it was generally in our land in 1 John 4, verse 5. And in England, the declension had gone so far that in 1736, Bishop Butler said, "It has come, I know not how, to be taken for granted by many persons that Christianity is not so much as a subject of inquiry, but that it is now at length discovered to be fictitious, and accordingly they treat it as if in the present age this were an agreed point among all people of discernment, and nothing remained but to set it up, a principal subject of mirth and ridicule, as it were by way of reprisals, for its having so long interrupted the pleasures of the world." Preface to his Analogy of Religion. But when the enemy was thus coming in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord lifted up a standard against him. George Whitefield, who was born in the city of Gloucester on December 16, 1714, converted while in the University of Oxford in 1733 and ordained in 1736, was wonderfully furnished with grace and gifts to proclaim doctrinal and practical Christianity through the British Empire. He sailed from England in December of 1737 to Georgia and returned through Ireland to England in December of 1738. He embarked again for America in August of 1739 and traveled and labored with great success as far northward as New York. He returned back to Georgia, from whence he went to South Carolina and sailed from there to New England, where he had been earnestly invited, and landed at Newport, September 14th, 1740. He preached there 3 days, and from there he came to Boston on the 18th. After preaching there and near it many days, he went as far eastward as Old York to see our excellent Moody, and then he returned and preached at Boston until October 12th, after which he went up westward to Northampton to see Jonathan Edwards and roused the people there. He then turned down by Hartford and New Haven and away to New York, through New Jersey and Philadelphia, and embarked from Delaware Bay, December 1st, 1740. And he then said, "Oh, my soul, look back with gratitude on what the Lord has done for you in this excursion. I think it is the 75th day since I arrived at Rhode Island. My body was then weak, but the Lord has much renewed its strength. I've been enabled to preach, I think, 175 times in public, besides exhorting frequently in private. I have traveled upwards of 800 miles and gotten upwards of 700 pounds sterling in goods, provisions, and money for the Georgia orphans. Never did God vouchsafe to me greater comforts. Never did I see such a continuance of the divine presence in the congregations to whom I have preached." End quote. Collection of his journals, page 437. When he went through New Jersey, he prevailed with Gilbert Tennant to take a tour into this field, which was white already unto the harvest. And he came to Boston in December and labored in these parts until March, when it came round by Plymouth, Middleborough, Bridgewater, Taunton, Newport, and Providence, and so returned home through Connecticut. Both of them, in their preaching, laid open the dreadful danger of hypocrisy as well as profaneness, and spake as plainly against unconverted ministers and professors as any other sort of sinners, and the effects were exceeding great and happy. Some indeed tried to persuade the world that the great change then made in the land was chiefly owing to the mechanical influence of their terrible words, gestures, and moving ways of address. But Thomas Prince of Boston says, "As to George Whitefield's preaching, it was in a manner moving, winning, and melting, but the mechanical influence of this, according to the usual operation of mechanical powers, in 2 or 3 days expired, with many in 2 or 3 hours, and I believe with the most as soon as the sound was over, or they got out of the house, or in the first conversation they fell into. But with the manner of his preaching, wherein he appeared to be in earnest, he delivered those vital truths which animated all our martyrs, made them triumph in flames, and led his hearers into the view of that vital, inward, active piety, which is a mere effect of the mighty and supernatural operation of a divine power on the souls of men, which only will support and carry through the sharpest trials, and make fit for the inheritance of the saints in light," end quote. As to Gilbert Tennant, he says, "In private converse with him, I found him to be a man of considerable parts and learning, free, gentle, condescending, and from his own various experience, reading the most noted writers on experimental divinity, as well as the scriptures, and conversing with many who had been awakened by his ministry in New Jersey, where he then lived. He seemed to have had as deep an acquaintance with the experimental part of religion as any I have conversed with, and his preaching was as searching and rousing as ever I heard. He seemed to have no regard to please the eyes of his hearers with agreeable gestures, nor their ears with delivery, nor their fancy with language, but to aim directly at their hearts and consciences, to lay open their ruinous delusions, show them their numerous secret hypocritical shifts in religion, and drive them out of every deceitful refuge, wherein they made themselves easy with a form of godliness without the power." Prince's Christian History, Volume 2, page 384 to 387. Religion was much revived at Boston, Northampton, and other places in the fall and winter, and in the 2 years following, the work spread through most parts of New England, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, beyond all that was ever known before in America. Several ministers who were converted before were now greatly quickened, and spent much of their time in traveling and preaching in various parts of the land. Others who had been blind guides before were now spiritually enlightened and heartily joined in this great work. 3 of them were Mr. William Hobby of Reading, Mr. John Porter of Bridgewater, and Mr. Daniel Rogers, a tutor in Harvard College, who all acknowledged George Whitefield to be the instrument of their conversion. A number of young scholars also met with a change in these times and came into the ministry in which they did much for the good of souls. Religious meetings and religious conversation engaged the attention of a great part of the people in most parts of the land. A reformation of life, confessing their former faults, and making restitution for injuries done, were evident in many places, and a vast number of all ages made a profession of religion and joined to the several churches where they lived. But a great majority of the ministers and rulers through the land disliked this work and exerted all their powers against it. And as many imperfections appeared therein, this gave them many plausible excuses for so doing. But Jonathan Edwards delivered a sermon at New Haven in September of 1741, in which he well distinguished between the marks of a true work of God and all false appearances of it, which was printed and spread through the nation and was much esteemed. An anonymous answer to it was soon published at Boston, and many appeared against the work in Massachusetts, but they could not get any law made against it, as they did in Connecticut. Governor Talcott died there in October of 1741, while their legislator was sitting, who then elected another governor who was greatly in favor of ministerial power, and they called a consociation of ministers to meet at Guilford in November. And they drew up a number of resolves, in one of which they said that for a minister to enter into another minister's parish and preach or administer the seals of the covenant without the consent of, or in opposition to the settled minister of the parish, is disorderly. Mr. Robbins of Branford had done something like it before at New Haven, for which others had reproved him, and he had made some concessions to them. In December, he received a letter from a Baptist minister at Wallingford, informing him that Joseph Bellamy had preached to their society to mutual satisfaction, and desiring that he would do the like. This request appeared agreeable, and he appointed a meeting for this purpose on January 6, 1742. But 2 days before that time, a deacon from Wallingford brought him a letter signed by 42 men in their town, and another signed by two ministers who lived by the way, desiring him not to go to preach to those Baptists without giving any reason against it, but their desire. And as this did not appear to him a sufficient reason to violate his promise, and to disappoint a people who were desirous to hear the gospel, he went and preached two sermons to them. Yet for this he was complained of a disorderly person to the Consociation of New Haven County, February 9th. He asked how it could be disorderly since he preached to a particular religious society at the request of their pastor. They answered that it was not a lawful society, but a disorderly company. He replied that Governor Talcott had advised Wallingford collectors not to distrain ministerial taxes from them, and the authority sent them annual proclamations for fasts and thanksgivings as to other societies. That Baptist church in Wallingford was formed, and Mr. John Merriman was ordained their pastor in 1739. But they disregarded these reasons and expelled him out of their consociation. This is about the time that David Brainerd was expelled out of Yale College, who did the most afterwards towards spreading Christianity among the Indians of any man in our day. How far were the above actions from a Catholic behavior toward the Baptists, pretended by many? Those ministers procured a law to be made in May of 1742, in which it was enacted that if any settled minister in their government should preach in the parish of another without his consent, he should lose all the benefit of their laws for his support, and that if any man who was not a settled minister should go into any parish and preach without such consent, he should be imprisoned until he gave £100 bond not to do so again. And if any minister came out of any other government and preached without such consent, he should be taken up by authority and carried as a vagrant person out of Connecticut. At the same time, they had an old law by which every person was to be fined 10 shillings who drew off from parish ministers and met for worship in a place separate from them. What tyranny was this? And though Massachusetts had no power to make such laws about preachers, yet said Connecticut law was printed in a Boston newspaper, and many did all they could against traveling ministers and against the work in general. But Jonathan Edwards published a book on the other side in 1742, showing that the work then going on in the land was a glorious work of God, the duty of all to acknowledge and to promote it, and the great danger of the contrary, in which its friends had been injuriously blamed. What ought to be corrected among them, and what ought positively to be done to promote the work? This book was much esteemed in Europe as well as in America. Yet Dr. Charles Chauncey of Boston was so much displeased with it that he set off and traveled through the country as far as Philadelphia, picking up all the evils that he could find and some reports that were not true concerning the work, and published them in 1743 as an answer to Jonathan Edwards. In an introduction of about 30 pages, he tries to prove that this work was carried on by the same spirit and errors that were condemned by the Synod of 1637. But what has been before recited, and much more that might be produced, plainly shows the contrary. He then spends about 300 pages upon what he calls things of a bad and dangerous tendency in the late religious appearances in New England. And the first thing which he so calls is itinerant preaching, which he said had its rise in these parts from George Whitefield, who was followed by Gilbert Tennent and others. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of a parenthesis here and tell you that not only was George Whitefield and Tennent being falsely charged by people like Charles Chauncey in America, Whitfield was also being charged by people like Ralph Erskine, one of the Merrill men from Scotland, and also from James Fraser, who had written a commentary on the confession. And I have read those, and they were so vitriolic towards George Whitfield. And thankfully, later on, many years later, they apologized for these writings and said that they wished that they had never been written and were written in a time of great passion. I go into that in some detail when I teach on the Great Awakening. So to continue, before Charles Chauncy cites any scripture against it, he mentioned their law against it in Connecticut, which he observed had been printed in one of the Boston papers, after which he produced what is said in the scriptures concerning idle, disorderly walkers who eat the bread of others for naught, 2 Thessalonians 3, verses 6 to 11. And then he mentioned the caution against being busybodies and other men's manners in 1 Peter 4, 15. But this could not answer his turn without mending the translation and observing that the word busybody is episcopus, which is often translated bishop. And the evil here warned against, he says, is one that plays a bishop in another's diocese. Chauncy Thoughts, pages 36 to 42. But it is well known that the word means an overseer and is so rendered in Acts 20, 28. A busybody, then, is an overseer in the affairs of others, and in the two scriptures which he produced, it is applied to Christians in general and is not confined to ministers. All should take heed that they do not intermeddle with the affairs of others which do not belong to them. Two other scriptures he brings which belong to ministers that condemn the committing of themselves and entering into the line of others and a building upon another man's foundation, 2 Corinthians 10, verses 12 to 17, and Romans 15, verse 20. And these are his scriptures to prove that a minister ought not to preach in any parish where another was settled by the laws of men without his consent, pages 43 to 45. But all ought to know that the line of conduct which God has drawn in his word and the foundation which he has laid for his church is as high above all establishments for worship by human laws as heaven is above the earth. Jonathan Edwards, on the other hand, has said, if ministers preach never so good a doctrine and are never so painful and laborious in their work, yet if at such a day as this they show to the people that they are not well affected to this work, but are very doubtful and suspicious of it, they will be very likely to do their people a great deal more hurt than good. For the very fame of such a great and extraordinary work of God, if their people were allowed to believe it to be his, in the example of other towns, together with what preaching they might hear occasionally, would be likely to have a much greater influence upon the minds of the people to awaken and animate them in religion than all their labors with them. And we that are ministers, by looking on this work from year to year with a displeased countenance, shall effectually keep the sheep from their pasture, instead of doing the part of shepherds to them, by feeding them. And our people had a great deal better be without any settled minister at all at such a day as this. The times of Christ remarkably appearing in behalf of his church, and to revive religion and advance his kingdom in the world, are often spoken of in the prophecies of Scripture as times in which he will remarkably execute judgment on such ministers or shepherds as do not feed the flock but hinder their being fed, and so deliver his flock from them, as Jeremiah 23, Ezekiel 34, Zechariah 10, Isaiah 46, and so on. That's a quote from Thoughts on the Present Revival of Religion by Jonathan Edwards, 1744, pages 133 to 136. How solemn are these considerations? And we have before seen that Dr. Increase Mather in the year 1700 said, if the began apostasy should proceed as fast the next 30 years as it has done these last, surely it will come to that in New England that the most conscientious people therein will think themselves concerned to gather churches out of churches. And though he knew not the exact time, yet this came to pass in 45 years in the following manner. Now, leaving this history from Isaac Backus and quoting something off of the internet from Christianity Today, quote, while the Baptists had shown some opposition to the awakening, they shared dramatically in its fruitfulness. During the period of 1740 to 1760 in New England, Baptist churches increased from 21 to 79. In the South, the foundation was laid for the enormous Baptist expansion there later. End quote. Now, before ending this podcast, many of the listeners may know that there is an awful lot of opposition in our day to the idea of whether or not there was any Great Awakening at all. And I've heard different reasons for this. I think part of it is some of the people that are or were against the Great Awakening were people that are exclusive psalmody. And so historically, because hymns were much used in revivals of religion, they supposed that the revival could not have been genuine. And I knew somebody back in Grand Rapids that held that view, but thankfully his pastor, who had come from Scotland, brought him around on that whole subject. But over at Westminster West, you have men like R. Scott Clark, who are also in doubt about whether there really was a Great Awakening. And in that case, it has more to do with such an emphasis on what is called the covenant nurturing model of conversions, that children are raised in a Christian home, in a covenant home, as they would say. And as a result, typically, any kind of conversion like that you would find during the Great Awakening, and in his case, he particularly goes after the conversion of Phoebe Bartlett, the four-year-old that is mentioned in Jonathan Edwards' narrative of surprising conversions, and says that the normal type of conversion in a covenant home should be one in which the child doesn't really know the time of his conversion because he has been exposed to Christian instruction all along. Well, that's also the view of the Protestant Reformed churches back in Grand Rapids. In fact, so much so that one of their professors, Herman Hanko, and you can look this up on the internet, has an article called "Ought the Churches to Pray for Revival?" And to sum it up in one word, he believes no. To me, it's very refreshing to read this ecclesiastical history or history of the Baptist churches by Isaac Backus and see how he defends the revival against the charges of men like Charles Chauncey, especially because one of the groups of Baptists that attack the truth of a revival of religion are hyper-Calvinists who don't typically believe in evangelization anyway. So they have no use for Whitfield and Tennant and Edwards and so on. And we as Reformed Baptists want to distance ourselves from hyper-Calvinists in that regard. Well, thank you for tuning in to the history of the Baptists and the Great Awakening. This is Tom Sullivan, the voice of the Narrated Puritan, SermonAudio.com. The Man of God Network is an outreach of Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary, Owensboro, Kentucky.